All right, today I want to finish our discussion on the sacraments and on church government, how this church is governed. And when we get to the second theme, I hope you will look at this as a kind of guarantee, all right? And I know you've probably never heard anyone say that, but Presbyterian church government is there to keep things from getting weird. Let me change that. Keep things from getting weirder. All right, they're already weird in this church, but we have a form of government that will keep us really from going off the deep end, and that should make you feel good. And I'll talk more about that in a moment. First, let me ask: anyone here from a Catholic background, born or raised Catholic? Okay. All right. Anyone here from a Baptist background? All right. Anyone here from like a non-denominational? Okay. Thanks for confessing that. No, just kidding. PCA stands for Perfect Church in America, as you know. So, all right. So today I'm going to kind of contrast these two extremes in the church and in church history, and I'm going to talk a little bit about the via media, the middle way that came out of John Calvin's thinking, and that the Reformed Church, that's this, our branch of Christianity, has kind of adopted, all right? So, and this applies both to our view of sacraments and our view of church governance, all right? So you'll see that if we kind of map it out on the popular ways that were taken in church history, you'll see that we're kind of right in the middle of things. All right, so again, on this side, you have the Eastern Orthodox Church, the Roman Catholic Church. As you move toward the center a little bit, but you'll find high church Anglican churches or high church Episcopalian churches that if you walked in there and actually went through a service, you'd think, I'm pretty sure I'm in a Catholic church. They're very, you know, there'd be incense, candles burning, smells and bells, as we say in the our arrogant Reformed church. When the incense comes in, the spirit goes out. That's what we say. So again, at that end, you'd find a great emphasis on liturgy, a great emphasis on tradition, a big emphasis on hierarchy, where you'd find a whole hierarchy extending downward from the Pope. So you have the Pope, and you have cardinals, you have archbishops, bishops, then the senior pastors of congregations would be called Monsignor. So that would be me. I'd be the Monsignor of this church. In fact, one time I married someone, and I was wearing a black robe with red piping, and my faithful assistant, Grace, picked out the little crosses. I didn't want the little crosses in there, so she picked out the embroidery, and I married someone from a Catholic background, Irish Catholic from New York. And as I was leaving the congregation, this real New York plumber came up to me. He goes, "Hey, Monsignor, good service." You know. So anyway, I'm the Monsignor of this church. You don't have to call me that, Jonathan. So anyway, on this side, you know what that high church is about. You can kind of figure that. And then at this side, the emphasis would be on freedom, not tradition. We're moving with the Spirit. Actually, Jonathan today we're preparing to use him in the service today. So he kind of wanted to know, you know, how we should prepare. And Phil and I said, "Man, you don't have to prepare at all. We have it written right out for you. There's no freedom out here." So on this side, you have no liturgy. Everybody has a liturgy, but it's a very kind of fluid, free, liberated kind of liturgy. And then not a real emphasis on hierarchy. I actually, you know, in this way, I don't really like to be called Pastor TJ, just TJ. We don't call him like Electrician Bill, so why should you call me Pastor TJ? That's my feeling. Anyway, so again, freedom is kind of the autonomy of the local congregation. So if you have a Baptist church in the heart of New York City, and you have a Baptist church founded in a cornfield in Iowa, you know, they can be very different. And for the good, you know, because they can kind of incarnate the gospel for their particular neighborhood and what have you. And again, on this side, much more tradition. That side, much more liberty and freedom. When it comes to the sacraments, the emphasis on this side is on the clergyman. The clergyman is endowed with authority. He, in some sense, is given the keys to the kingdom. He has the authority of Peter. That's been, you know, he's in line to Peter. He, again, is set apart and sanctified and given authority. So the emphasis here is on what Protestants remember, and the Catholics have used this in their defense of their position, as ex opere operato. Ex opere operato. Out of the working, it is worked. That's what it means. Out of the working, it is worked. So you're on your deathbed, and you call for a priest, and he comes and anoints you with oil, and he kind of saves you. And even if you haven't been baptized, what the priest did actually works. It works for you. We've been to, Missy and I have been to a number of different funerals for Catholic people, and the huge emphasis is on the fact that this person was baptized. Now, we know the person didn't go to church, didn't believe in God, had no real interest in the gospel, but when it comes to being baptized, ex opere operato, because the priest baptized him, and that actually did something to him. And probably they wouldn't like this term, but I'll use it anyway, and that is automatic. There's an automatic transference of grace. That's one of the reasons why in the serving of the Lord's Supper in a Catholic church, someone holds a plate under the worshiper's chin. You get it? If the host goes into your mouth and you kind of freak out and pull away or whatever, and it drops, you have to catch it, because once the priest says the words of institution that he's been given by Rome over those elements, they actually become, something automatic happens. In some way, a divine mystery, they become the body and blood of Jesus. Now, I used this illustration once, and one of our members, who's an attorney, so I kind of went with him on this. Also, he was a former altar boy, so he has a much closer inside view than I do, but my parents taught me, and I guess this was kind of apocryphal, it wasn't really the teaching of the Catholic Church, but there's a point in the Catholic Mass where the priest says the words of divine institution, and something happens. If you're actually in the Mass, something sensible happens right then. Does anyone know what it is? He says the words, and something takes place. And you're warned. I was taught. He told me that this was not true exactly, but he told me that it was to demarcate the high point of the Mass. I was always taught that we should avert our eyes, all right? We should turn away at that point because, I actually grew up in a home that when we said the word Jesus, we always had to go Jesus, like that. We had to bow our heads every time. So when the priest says the words of divine institution over the sacramental elements, the bread and the wine, the altar boy rings a bell, all right? And when he rings the bell, again, I was taught to avert my eyes because a divine mystery is taking place. And it was like, seeing someone not dressed. You should turn away at that point because it's like the glory of God, as Moses was told, don't look at the front, only the aftermath of the glory. Because you'll be turned to dust, if you see it. So we're to turn away. Again, my friend in this church said it's not exactly official Catholic teaching, but it's the same kind of idea that this is the high point of the Mass, a divine mystery is taking place, physical bread is being turned into a spiritual reality, right? That somehow Jesus is actually in that bread, and when you take the bread, ex opere operato, you actually get grace. It's automatically transferred to you. And it's not anything you bring to the table. It's just completely automatic. The priest does it. It's on the authority of the church. It's completely of grace. It's not of you. You don't bring anything to the table. At this end, the idea is that the sacraments, both communion and baptism, are in some sense a declaration that the believer makes and a memory that the believer receives. When I was
a young minister, like Jonathan,
when I first came here, I used to have to do every week. It was the highlight of my ministerial experience. Every week I had to do a children's sermon. So at the second service, all the kids come forward, and whatever the pastor is preaching on, I did it like a way pared down, 3-minute kind of thing, right? And it was common for us to use object lessons. So one time I used a piece of paper and a piece of flash paper. I don't know if you know what flash paper is. You get it at a magic store. Like I got mine from Hogwarts. You know, no. And so I said, this is the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world, children. In what sense does he take away sin? And I said, has he taken away your sin? All the kids go, yes. And then I said, so you don't sin anymore. That's what they said. And so then I burned the piece of paper, and it kind of burned slowly, you know. And then I took, and I had the word S-I-N written on the paper. Then I took the piece of flash paper, had S-I-N on it. I held it over the candle. It's gone. This is guilt. This is commission of sin. You get it? Guilt, bam, is taken away the moment we first believe. It just evaporates. And that's what flash paper does. It just, there's a little flash, and there's not even an ash after that. It just absolutely vanishes. This is what Jesus does to our guilt, takes it totally away. We have no record of sin. This is what Jesus does to our committing sin, kind of goes slowly. And oftentimes, it goes out, we have to keep coming to the candle to light it. All right, so that's an object lesson. Communion and baptism at this end are kind of seen in that light. It's an object lesson that continuously stirs up the believer to believe. You're remembering that Jesus gave himself to us. Yes?
I think one of the biggest takeaways that I had too is this justification, how that occurs. So similar to what you're saying, that you know, every time you do that, it's continuing that justification process. We believe justification happens.
Yes. Right. That's right. So again, we see justification as being a pronouncement that God makes, and justification in that view is a kind of measuring up to that thing. And if you measure up enough, I guess somehow you get enough grace, yeah. Okay, so again, when I take the Lord's Supper, it's an object lesson. It's a remembrance. And I remember, oh yeah, I'm depending on Jesus. Jesus is given to me. His body is broken for me. All that comes home to me in a very powerful way. And we don't deny this, and we really don't deny that, but we have a third way of looking at it, and this is that in... Let me go back and tell you how the Protestants work through this. Going all the way back to the Protestant Reformation, Martin Luther had a number of compatriots who were really in the foxhole with him, and one of them was a guy named, I think a Swiss guy named Ulrich Zwingli. And Ulrich Zwingli and Luther agreed on 99% of everything. Luther wanted to basically keep Catholic worship the way it was. He only wanted to break on the Catholic view of justification, on that this is a pronouncement by God, not something that we, you know, walk in. We walk in sanctification, but we receive justification in an instant. Luther wanted to hold that, so did Zwingli, but Luther wanted to, after that, basically hold to the Catholic idea of worship. Zwingli said, no, we have to reform the church from top to bottom, the whole thing. Not only the, once you get justification wrong, everything else kind of falls apart, and we have to rebuild everything. So their students realized, you know, you guys agree on 99% of the stuff, but when we hear you teach in the classroom, you sound different when it comes to the sacraments and worship. So could you guys get together and hammer it out? So they did. There's actually a painting of this. It's called The Colloquy of Marburg, all right? And it shows Luther on one end of the table and Zwingli on the other end, and they're both, you know, going like this. I mean, these were like beer-drinking, you know, swashbuckling theologians who, these guys were not wimpy guys, you know? I mean, they were ready to be stoned to death at any moment. That, you know, so they were strong guys, and so they start to argue, and Luther starts pounding on the table. He says in German, and we've had German speakers here. I was hoping that Sylvia would be here today. She could say this in German, although he might have said it in Latin too. But he said, "This is my body." You know, he kept saying it. Jesus didn't say, "This is like my body." He said, "It is my body." And that Luther was pounding on the table. And at the same time, on the other end of the table, Zwingli is saying, "Do this in remembrance of me." You get it? Remembrance of me. This is my body. Remembrance of me. This is my body. And they're going back and forth. They're getting more and more heated. And at once, they stand up and they leave the classroom. And they never fixed it. And as a result, you have Baptists following Zwingli. And you have Lutherans following Luther. And then, and let me, when I say his name, will everyone rise? John Calvin. No, just kidding. Calvin comes along and says, "Let's have less filling and taste great." Like the beer commercials, right? "Let's have peanut butter and chocolate, like a Reese's cup, you know? Why do we have to have one or the other? Why not have both and?" Calvin says, "Jesus is present in the meal, not attached to the bread, not even as the Lutherans would say," and, you know, they might, I don't know, I'm not really a Lutheran theologian, so they might disagree exactly with what I'm saying, but they said that the presence of Jesus is around the bread, you know, and the Catholics said that it's kind of in the bread becomes it, and Calvin said, no, Jesus is at the meal in some special way. He wasn't able to really define that, but Jesus is there to give himself to our faith the way the pastor gives the bread to your mouth. The way the bread is given to the mouth, so grace and Jesus is given to your faith. We actually receive Jesus in the supper. All right? So we're not saying that we get saved again and again. We're saying that he's nourishing us on himself. He is the nourishment of the Christian life. It's not our energy. It's not our willpower. It's not praying enough. It's not doing this enough or tithing or whatever. The nourishment for the Christian life is Jesus. It's continuously coming to him, depending on him, receiving him. We don't say that we receive Christ once. We do say we get saved once, but we receive Jesus again and again. Great passage in, and it's, I think, very important to us at this congregation, in the very core of the book of Letter to the Galatians. And Paul says to them, "The only thing I want to know from you is this." And, you know, when someone is writing a letter and they say, "This is the bottom line," you should really pay attention to that. When it's the apostle, you should really pay attention to that. He says, "The only thing I want to know from you is this. Did you receive Christ from obeying the law or from hearing with faith?" And of course the answer is no. Obeying the law, first of all, I never really obeyed it very well. Second of all, that's not how I got Christ. I got him by despairing of my doing and by believing in him, hearing with faith. And then Paul goes on to say, how do you think you'll continue in the Christian life? And the answer is hearing with faith. You know, you don't get the Spirit and his continued operations in you by doing things, obeying the law or obeying the commandments of man. You get Christ today the way you got him at the very start, hearing with faith. All right. So again, it's very important to us and to Protestants in general, and to Paul. It's a central tenet of his faith in that letter. All right. So again, Calvin is right here in the center. We do get Jesus, and we do come with faith. There is a remembrance, and there's something that does take place in our life. We come in repentance and faith. We put faith to work on Christ. Our faith consumes Christ as our mouth consumes the bread. Kaylee. In other words, this side ignores that it's possible to take the bread in an unworthy manner. Well, not really, because in the Catholic Church, even though I might go forward and take the bread, and they're not going to probably ask for my Catholic card, you know, but really only Catholic people are supposed to take the bread. So in that sense, to take the bread in an unworthy manner would be to take it being apart from the Mother Church. So a Protestant, they called Protestants separated brethren. That's their word in Vatican II for Protestant people. So we're brothers, but not really, we didn't really join the Mother Church, so we shouldn't take the Lord's Supper.
But also indicate that they had a sin on their heart, that they had not confessed.
Yeah.
So they shouldn't take communion if they have something they have not confessed. The priest, especially if it's they kind of have different categories of sins, and some that are greater than others.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Right, and that's the problem. You know, I mean, I think we can all see that because, you know, Luther would spend like hours in the confessional booth, and he'd be thinking, you know, there was a monk and he had more bread than I did at the meal, and I was jealous of him, and he was racking his brain. And then after hours, and the priest would be like, yes, what else? You know, on the other side, Luther would get out and say, I feel so much better. Not like Brother Dominic. Oh no, I just like had an envy thing, you know, or a you know competition thing, and he'd ask the priest, hey, I have one more, and you know, again, you're supposed to go to confession before you take the Lord's Supper in the Catholic Church, but most people don't, and as soon as you leave confession, you know, you begin to sin again. So how can you, again, venial, you can have minor sins and still, I guess, take the Lord's Supper, maybe. But. All right, so again, this side, ex opere operato. When the priest does it, it's done. And that's why we've had people call here, and one of the reasons why we changed our name is because St. Andrew's used to mean a region in Scotland to Presbyterians, but today in our milieu, St. Andrew's means Catholic. So we changed it because once in a while we'd have a person call, hi, my child is sick and I need for him to be baptized today. And we understood after a while, oh, what this is, he thinks we're a Catholic church, and he thinks if my child dies today, unbaptized, he'll have his original sin and he'll have to spend, you know, so many hundreds of years in purgatory for his sins. When the Catholics baptize someone, they take away your original guilt. The guilt of Adam is now expunged from your record under the Catholic way of thinking. So again, we don't think of it that way. On the other hand, we do see it as something that God is doing. If you ever are at a baptism here, we stress that God is now giving you something. He's making a promise to you. And baptism is something we receive. We baptize, of course, infants and adults, but it's the same thing. God is making a promise to you, a covenant to you in this baptism, and we receive it. It's not something that we do. It doesn't point to what happened like in my hospital bed when I first believed. It points to a hill far away. That's what baptism points to. It points to what Jesus did for me in outside Jerusalem on a trash heap, you know, on the cross. That's what baptism points toward. Yes? Okay, yeah.
That was a sign and seal, you know, and it didn't matter if the young Jewish child wanted it to happen or not, but that was a sign and seal of that covenant.
Mm-hmm.
And in the same manner, he's given us baptism as a
yes.
Sign and seal.
Right. So that gets us into the idea of baptism for infants, or the what they call the subjects of baptism. Why do we baptize infants and the Baptists don't? So at the high church end, they do baptize infants. Even in the Orthodox Church, they actually submerge infants, and some really funny YouTube videos about that. I'm not sure whether to ask you to look at them or not, because some of them are kind of almost blasphemous. But yeah, they had like a line where they're dunking. You know, it's like donuts. You know, kind of. So why do we baptize children? And as Luke kind of gave me that segue, so as the sacrament of initiation, again, if I ask anyone on this entire spectrum, you could be, you know, non-denominational, charismatic, whatever on this end, or you could be high church as they come. And if I ask any theologian of any stripe in the Christian church, anyone, I'm not talking about Jehovah's Witnesses or Mormons, people who are really, they're off the spectrum. But if I ask anyone, what is the ritual of initiation? What ritual is given to a person to receive him into the life of the church? Everyone will say baptism. Just as in the Old Testament, if I asked any Jewish person, what is the ritual of initiation into the Jewish church? They would always say circumcision. Now again, women didn't get that, and little girls didn't get it, but it was given to the head of the household as his way in. That's why when Christians, people converted to Christ from a Gentile background, Jewish Christians said, well, they should get that ritual of circumcision, right? And, you know, Paul's idea was, well, baptism unites us to Christ as circumcision once united us to Christ. And just as circumcision, of course, was given to infants, and they didn't have any say in the matter, if they did have a say in the matter, probably they'd say no, right? Because it hurt. So just as infants were included in the covenant community through circumcision, we also include infants in the covenant community through baptism. Did I say that right? Okay. When it comes to the Lord's Supper, again, the emphasis is on how Jesus is there for us and becomes our nourishment. You might ask, well, if you gave one sacrament to infants, why don't you give the other sacrament to infants? Some people, there's a minority in the Presbyterian Church that does hold that as soon as children can chew bread, they should get the Lord's Supper. You know, we don't hold to that, and you're not allowed to really hold it in our denomination, but there are still some people that, you know, wish it was going to go that way. Our idea here is that anyone who cannot judge the body, and what we take that to mean, and that's why if you've ever heard us introduce the Lord's Supper in this church, you might, you know, kind of go along with it and then, what? We say that you should be a member in good standing of some church that teaches the gospel. Now, that's very unusual for modern evangelicalism. Even Presbyterian churches sadly don't do it. I've heard people in our presbytery that are really weak on it, and we actually had a case, and I'll talk about these cases in a moment, that went all the way to the Supreme Court about what one guy was teaching in our own presbytery about that. But we hold that to rightly judge or rightly discern the body means that you have to understand that, Luke, what is your rank in the Navy? You're a commander. So at work, I salute him and call him Commander Kelvington, right? But in the church, I don't salute him. I embrace and kiss him because while in secular life, he's here and I'm here, but in the life of the church, we're both on a plane. I now think of him as a brother, not as a commander, in that sense, you know what I mean? And he could even be a member of a church where there's a private who's an elder in the church, you know? So the body is a place where all of our distinctions, where I'm a master and you're a slave, or you're a slave and I'm a master, whatever, all those are forgotten, and we're all on the same ground. And in the church at Corinth, the rich were clearly being favored. They could get to church earlier, and by the time the poor people got off work and got there, all the bread and the wine was gone. And the poor people said, wait a minute, I think this is the place where we're supposed to be equal, but we're not being treated equal. And Paul said, you're using the time where we're supposed to be completely fixated on our equality in Christ, and you're using it to somehow elevate some people over the others. This is, should not be the case, and this is the way to eat the body and drink the blood in an unworthy manner. It's not about having a sin on your record, as you mentioned. We all have sins on our record. It's about judging the church. What does the church mean? And if you can't do that yet, if you're a young person and you don't have the wherewithal to consider that, then you should not take the Lord's Supper. Again, this is all to say, We don't hold that. There's nothing to do with faith when we come to the Lord's Supper. It's not strictly automatic. That's not what we're saying. You do come with faith, and faith involves, you know, your head, your mind in some ways. All right, any thoughts on the sacraments?
I just have a question about the term, like, judging the church.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, in some settings, it seems like the child has to give you a theology of what I'm talking about right now. We don't hold that. You just have to know that the church is a place where everyone is equal in the sense that we're either in or we're out. It's not like we're in, really in, but I kind of am barely in. It's not that way. It's not that bow down to my superiors in the church, but that we all see ourselves as brothers and sisters. And that's what we mean to by judging the church, by discerning the body. That's how we take that. Is that?
Yeah, I think so. I guess my question is, does that hold, more or less, strictly the age, sort of in some other church traditions where it's, the Catholic Church, there's the confirmation, and, you become a certain age, and then you're deemed a bit able to judge the church, or is it more follow, this child has expressed on their own initiative, whether they're 4 or, 15, mm-hmm. that they are able to, judge the church.
Yeah, that's good. So, we used to have in this church, and it still is the practice in many Presbyterian churches, and also in Episcopal and Lutheran churches, they have something, and Catholic, they have something called confirmation. So you get to a certain age and they confirm you. I actually went through that in the Catholic Church. That's why I have this healthy glow about me. I don't know. We used to do it too. We didn't call it confirmation class, we called it communicants class. And we offered it to students when they came into middle school. But I was teaching it and I came to the senior pastor and said, some of these guys probably were ready 3 or 4 years ago. Some of these guys are just not there. They don't understand what salvation by grace is, never mind being able to discern the body. So now what we do is we offer this class, and we ask parents to just accompany their children through the class. And then the kids and the parents talk about it on their way home or through the week. Did you understand what the pastor was saying? That kind of thing. And parents, I don't know, how many hours are there in a week? 168? Anyway, Luke spends all these hours with Monroe. I only spend a little time with Monroe. So he knows, we trust the parent to know a lot more about the child's spiritual condition than the clergy and the pastors and elders would know. So we leave it up to the parents. You take your child into the inquirer's class when you see him or her being ready. We still examine them, the elders, but it's not a kind of automatic age thing. So go ahead, Kaylee. Yeah.
So is that the parents believing on behalf of the child?
Yes. What we say there is that the parents are performing spiritual CPR on the child. You get it? In CPR, I'm breathing for another person. In baptism, I'm believing for another person. You get it? That was helpful to me when I heard that. I thought you guys were going to go, wow, that was great. Thank you. Thank you, Jonathan. Okay, good. Yeah, good. So we're believing until that time when we can see the child believing for himself. And even when the child does believe for himself, we don't take our foot off the gas. We keep on praying with and for the kids and what have you. So is that helpful, Kaylee? Okay. Yes. Yes.
Quite literally, to me, that it included the children and didn't exclude the children.
Right. Yeah, and Abraham, you remember, was even told to circumcise his servants that weren't even blood relatives, because in that day and age, this household was everyone who came from you and even those who worked for you. So that's to say, almost certainly in that whole group, there would have been infants. All right, let me introduce church governance. I know this isn't like a real exciting thing, but the thing about this group is here you have external accountability when it comes to the life of the congregation. So if the congregation ever does something really strange or the pastor or Monsignor does something like snake handling, today we're going to have rattlesnakes. Anyone who would like to come forward and demonstrate their faith, and then Anna's thinking, I've been in a Presbyterian church my whole life. I've never seen this. This is really weird. You can, in this group, you can go to the hierarchy. You can go to the bishop, and you can say, look, we're having snake handling at so-and-so Catholic church, and I don't think we should be doing this. And then the bishop will come and say, you know, don't do that. In this group, you only have the pastors and the elders of the church. You don't have anyone outside of the church. This is called congregational government, and this is called the prelate system, but what we think of as the hierarchy. Problem with the hierarchy, the good thing about the hierarchy is there's someone I can appeal to. Bad thing about the hierarchy in this model is that he's only one person. So what we saw in the abuse scandals in the Catholic Church is that person sometimes was corrupt himself. So he heard about a criminal in the church, and he said, look, if I move you to another church, will you stop this? Absolutely, Bishop. And then they move him to another church, and it continues at another place. So too much power centered on one person. Again, on this side, a lot of freedom. You don't have to say if you're in a cornfield in Iowa, you don't have to be using Latin like they would in a place like, you know, where they speak Latin, like in Latin America. No, just kidding. So again, you can incarnate the gospel in your neighborhood with greater freedom. Bad part is you don't have anyone to appeal to. Missy and I were in a Baptist church. Again, I love the Baptists. I don't want to say anything bad about them or the non-denominational. They're brothers in the Lord. I'm not saying this is a capital H heresy that puts them outside like the Jehovah's Witnesses or Mormons. You know, again, I literally have brothers and sisters in Baptist churches, so blood brothers and spiritual. But on the negative part here is that you can't go outside of the congregation. So Missy and I were in a Baptist church in Columbia, South Carolina, and we saw some real irregularities that really rose to the occasion of criminal activity going in the church. And the pastor was called on the carpet for it, and he resigned. So we thought, okay, bummer, sad, terrible, hate to see it happen, but at least, you know, he was not going to do any more damage. And then they had a congregational meeting, and we showed up at the congregational meeting, and there were literally four times as many people as were there on a Sunday morning. So on Sunday morning, there's 50 people. We come to the congregational meeting, there's over 200 people. Parking lot was full of cars. And the family calls all their old cronies in, and all the people that don't come on Sunday morning vote for the pastor to stay, and all the people that are there on Sunday morning vote for the pastor to leave. And so he ends up staying. And then he says, well, what I really was confessing was I'm not tithing, I'm not praying enough, and I'm not reading the scriptures enough. Like, dude, that was not the charges that were leveled against you, you know? And so I called the local Baptist group. I love the Baptists. Did I say that already? I just want you to know I love the Baptists. But we called the local Baptist organization, and they said, we don't have any authority here. No authority? I mean, you have to send some sort of inquiry board or something to figure out what's going on. And then it dawned on me, oh, this is what my professors have been teaching me when they were talking about church polity. There's the autonomy of the local congregation, and there's no authority outside of the local congregation. Now, this is good news for you guys because this is a weird church. You know, we admit that. But if it ever gets criminally weird or doctrinally weird, you know, if I ever get up in front of the congregation and say, I went to the beach Saturday and God told me that I should tell you, if you do your best to keep the Ten Commandments, you will go to heaven. And, you know, Kara looks to Jonathan and says, Jonathan, we're in the wrong church. What is TJ talking about? And then Jonathan says, well, let's try to give TJ the benefit of the doubt. And then you come and I say, well, Jonathan, you're in seminary, but you haven't had as much experience as I do. You don't speak the Greek languages fluently. And Once you do, you'll understand that I really know my... And Jonathan can then appeal to my superiors, who are the elders of the church. We call it the session of the church. Session means to be seated. They're the ones seated in authority. He can come to the session and say, I think Kara and I really heard TJ say that salvation is by effort, our effort, not the effort of Jesus. And then maybe I say to the whole session, I've always suspected Kara was a troublemaker ever since I first met her. And this Jonathan, he's only got 1 year, year and a half of seminary under his belt. And they say, okay, well, we'll just placate them. And then they hear me say it again next week and then again the next week. And they go to the elders and they say, is there any recourse? The elders are required by their vows to say, yeah, you can appeal to the next highest court. It's the appellate court, the court of appeals, which is called the presbytery. And that's churches all the way from the border of Broward and Palm Beach County all the way to South Miami. All the churches in the PCA would hear their complaint and would have to rule on the complaint. Now, suppose I was able to work my magic on a whole presbytery, which I'm telling you, I can't even work my magic on the elders of this church. And we definitely do not have a bunch of yes men as elders. I mean, we're principally agreed on how the church should proceed, but there's no problem with someone saying, I don't think we should do this. So suppose I'm able to work my mojo on the whole presbytery, and they come back and they say, you know, we think you just guys need to be patient with TJ. He's fine. It'll work out. And then you guys say, it's not working out. He keeps saying, if you try your best, God will not reject you, which is salvation by works. And then you go to the presbytery and say, he's continuing. The presbytery is required to tell you about the next appeal that you can make, which is actually to the national board. You can actually make an appeal to the national, what they call judicial commission of the Presbyterian Church in America, who looks at not only moral difficulties, but also doctrinal difficulties. And that's made up of hundreds, 1,500 teaching and ruling elders from all over the United States. Now, I might be able to work mojo on the nine elders of this church. Probably I won't be able to on the 60 or 70 elders on the whole presbytery, but I certainly won't be able to do it in 1,500 guys. You know, they're going to consider this, and they're going to say, no, this is basically salvation by works. TJ has to renounce that, or he's going to be defrocked. We're going to take his credentials away. So again, that should be for you, I would think, a real bonus, because you know, we're asking you to make a big commitment. You're kind of committing your spiritual life and growth to this tennis court. You know, this is where you're going to play. Yes. Yeah, the PCA, Perfect Church in America, falls right here in the middle, both in terms of sacraments and in terms of church government. So we do have outward authority. We're not just an independent church where the congregation or the elders rule. We actually have someone who's checking up on us. And we have to submit, and Grace can attest to this because Grace is the one that does it, we have to submit the minutes of our meetings. So if the elders of our presbytery see, what? TJ's doing snake handling. It's in the minutes of their meeting. Someone's going to call me and say, this is an irregularity and we're asking you to answer for it. All right. So we have external authority, but it's not centered in one person. It's centered in the whole body of elders. Each congregation sends elders to the presbytery meeting 4 times a year. Is that okay? Kaylee, one last question. How many elders are there in the entire presbytery? Well, this church has 9 elders. That's probably an average, and we have 24 churches. So, again, they don't all come to presbytery. Each church is supposed to send their teaching elders and at least some of the ruling elders. So we usually bring 2 with us. There's a limit to how many you can bring or can't bring. All right, thanks for sticking with me. I know church governance isn't the most exciting thing, but you guys looked attentive, so thank you. Go in peace to love and serve the Lord.